Go.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star. How I wonder what you are. Up above, like a diamond in the sky.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy.
Hello, Kirsten.
Hi, Ed.
Monthly. Now when we say it, it actually means something.
How are you feeling about that?
Yeah. No, good. Good. I wanted it.
You did. And here it is.
Here it is, yeah. And we've now committed to it by doing this Patreon thing, which is a good segue into Patreon.
It is indeed.
How do you pronounce Patreon?
Well, I was saying Patreon as in patrons, and then someone said, no, it's Patreon as in patronage. I don't know.
Do you know, this conversation we're having now is had on about 400 podcasts every year. Someone says, well, we've got a Patreon. Oh, so, how do you pronounce it?
So someone needs to email the Patreon guys.
Correct.
And say, how do you, like, you invented it. How do you pronounce it? Maybe it's in their FAQ.
So because we've got wonderful listeners.
Yeah, it escalated quickly, didn't it?
It did. Wow. It did. We're up to 46 buckaroosies
a
month.
Yes, which is really exciting because it means that we will already have a Patron's Choice podcast later in the year, middle of the year, and we'll let everyone know how to nominate and vote and sort that out. I have to sort that out myself and then I'll let you know. So that will be fun.
What are you saying you have to sort it out yourself?
How to organise the nomination and voting. It's fine. We'll let everyone know. It's good.
I just don't want people to think that I'm not helping.
You're not helping.
No, I'm not. But I don't want people to think that. I've provided zero assistance.
Anyway, it's really exciting. And
it was actually quite funny when I said, so what's the passcode to the Patreon page? And you said, what do you want to know?
It's like, what are you up to?
What are you up to? What are you going to do? Oh, I'm going to take all the money. What do you think I'm going to do?
You actually could. You could change the account details and everything.
Could I?
No.
Okay.
Well, you could, but I would get an alert and then I would come and find you.
You know where I live because you're in my house right now.
So we did want to thank the people who have become patrons in the last month. It's really exciting. And we're just going to use first names. You all know who you are. So in no particular order, we would love to thank Stephanie, Angela, Scott, Jenny, Michelle, Nick, Carol, Sarah, Helena, Kerry, Deborah, and Alex. And also we have four patrons who selected the no reward function, and I'm not sure if that means they want to be named or not, so I'm not going to name them. You four lovely people know who you are.
Or if hopefully you know you are who you are.
Well,
do you want to tell them who they are?
But if you really do want to be named, and we would love to thank you publicly, send us a tweet now, or an email, and we shall do so on the next episode.
You told me that you're not sure if the email system works.
Yeah, because I did send out emails to a lot of people at the beginning before I changed the auto email to say, please let us know. And I never heard back from anyone except one, so I'm not sure whether the patron emails are going out properly or not. But anyway.
Look, we got your money, so frankly, we don't care. But
well,
no,
we haven't got it yet.
No, true. No, we actually don't. No, we won't till the.
Don't be blasé. Don't insult them; they'll all vaporise.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that now, what will happen is this gets posted on our normal Podbean thingy.
Yes,
but will it go on the Patreon page?
That, as well? Yes, that's how our lovely patrons contribute. So it will be cross posted. It will go on Podbean as normal for everybody who listens to us. You can listen to us as normal. You'll find it in all the same places. But in addition for patrons, it will go as a paid post on our Patreon page. There's a lot of P's in that sentence.
And while I won't say who gave what, I noticed there were two.
There are two people who chose the Kirsten Makes a Thing or Ian Sings a Song.
So what did they choose?
Oh, no, they haven't nominated yet. I will contact them after the six-month anniversary and say, what do you want?
So you might
have to sing a song. I have it on good authority that one of those people might be making you sing a song.
Okay.
Which I can't wait for. I almost want to patronise you myself just to make you sing a song. But it seems a false economy, so
it
I'm
does.
Not.
Yeah. So, and the great thing is, and just so people know, we struggled to get this podcast started this afternoon because of cables.
Because of a rogue cable that said, no, not today.
So we,
I'm retired.
Although the, you know, the money comes in monthly spits and spurts.
I'm going to buy new cables, people. Because
yes.
we almost lost last month's podcast, I'll just say, due to, I think, a dodgy cable.
Yes.
Because the first 10 minutes of it cut out on and off and was quite unlistenable. And it was a good thing we just like spent that time talking about the weather, really, so yeah, I could cut it out and it didn't really damage much. But
so while a lot of it will go to me personally, while a lot of the money will go to me personally, a small percentage will go to actually the decks and the things that we promised.
Yeah.
I just want to say, I know it's a bad joke, I just wanted to throw it.
Yeah,
okay,
getting,
let's talk about
you're
the
not
books.
Getting a cent. Anyway.
Yes. So we decided to do two anthologies.
We did.
They are, should I mention them?
No. Let's make anybody who hasn't listened to the last episode or read the show notes just guess as we go along.
They are Afro-SF, science fiction by African writers, edited by Ivor W. Hartman, and The Sea Is Ours, Tales from Steampunk Southeast Asia, edited by Jamie Goh and Joyce Chang.
Very well done. Well, they're long titles, so.
Yeah, and thank you for the patronising comments. So,
you want a dollar a month for that?
Which one? Which one are we going to start with?
Well, I did make a helpful running sheet.
Yes, so we're going to start with Afro-SF because that's the first one I read out.
I don't know why I bother.
Which has 22 authors in it?
Something like that. It's about twice as long as The Sea Is Ours.
Yes, it is. And interestingly, the second volume just came out.
Yes.
This came out in late 2012, December 2012, early 2013, and it was published by Storytime, which
yep.
I believe is Ivor Hartman's
small press
company. Yep.
Yep.
And he just literally published the most recent volume, volume two, which was only reviewed on Strange Horizons today.
Oh.
That's how I know about it.
That's how you know about it.
Because it's just on my feed. I thought,
wait,
we haven't done the podcast yet. Why is this? Oh, it's the second volume. It's a completely different cover. And the second volume is six novellas.
It's a different cover.
It's a completely different cover. And six novellas as well. It's not short stories.
Oh, okay.
Yes, so, but we won't talk about the second volume because neither of us have read it.
No, we have not.
What we said we would do. So, look, how do you want to go about this?
What do you mean?
Well, do we want to – how do we – look, these are very – both these anthologies are very specific in what they're trying to achieve.
Yes, they are.
They're not general anthologies in that – although, interestingly, Afro-SF is a specific African writer anthology, but there was no theme. There was no – other than the fact that the stories, I think, are set in Africa, correct?
Heavily in South Africa and Nigeria.
Yeah, but they could have...
But other African nations as well.
But they could have any sort of science fiction element, time travel, AI...
Or fantasy. It was speculative.
Well, no, it was Afro-SF, Afro-science fiction. It wasn't Afro-SFF. No, I'm being serious. You're laughing at me. It's not African science fiction and fantasy. I think the point was African science fiction. Oh, God, let's not get into... No, I can already see where this is going to go.
There's quite a bit of fantasy creeping in there on the margins.
Well, that's, you know... It's interesting because it starts with a short excerpt from the first – well, it's the first chapter of Lagoon by Nnedi Okorafor, which is exactly that sort of moulding, melding, merging of genre, which because it includes both African mythology and, you know, alien first contact invasion. Well, it's not really an alien invasion. Aliens and it's set in Nigeria. So it does do that thing of merging SF and F together.
Yes.
Yeah, you're just looking at me.
No, I just haven't read Lagoon, so.
Haven't you?
No, I haven't.
Well, I'm going to shame you for not.
Why?
Because it's a really, really good book. It's probably one of the best books I read last year.
There are so many books.
No, but seriously, there's lots of really good books and lots of really shitty books, but I'm just saying that Lagoon is a fucking great book.
It is on my post-PhD list, which will itself take the length of a PhD to actually get through, so.
Yeah, although Lagoon is a very easy read. Yes, there's a moulding, merging. Why am I saying moulding?
I don't know.
Mouldy.
Melding.
There's melding.
Don't say mouldy. That's not a nice word.
There's a merging of science fiction and fantasy.
Yeah.
Although I thought it was stronger on the science fiction.
But, yeah, yeah, okay. No, I'd agree with that.
Okay. Now, okay, so the point I was going to make before I was really derailed by you providing facts is, as you always
I'm
do
annoying
in
that
this
way.
Podcast, yes, very, is that there was a more, while, yes, African focus, there was a more general tone in the topics, whereas the second anthology, The Sea Is Ours, is focused on steampunk stories.
Yes.
Which is my biggest problem with these two anthologies. In
that the African one isn't steampunk, or that the Asian one is?
That the Asian one gets very samey after a while.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah, but to be fair though, that's the problem with all theme anthologies.
I was just about to say that. Yeah, I mean it is, you know, but it doesn't have to be. I can't remember the name of it anymore, but I read an anthology 10 years ago or more. I want to say it's edited by Ellen Datlow, I think it was, and it was about cats. And
really?
Yeah. And you'd think, oh, that's...
Did you read it because it was edited by Ellen Datlow?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
And I just remember it being really good and not repetitive. And yes, every story was featured a cat or feline theme in some way, but it was a really good anthology. I wish I could remember the name. I'm so sorry, Ellen. I will look that up and put it in the show notes.
Okay, so that...
So I just wanted to make the point that having a theme, even a really narrow theme, doesn't necessarily mean an anthology is going to, sort of flatline in the sense of where the stories go.
And it's not helped. And look, it's I've got to be fair, I don't like steampunk.
No, it's
at all. And, yeah. And I know we're going all over the place here. We're talking about
these. I
think
we can just talk about them together. Yeah, I think that will be the easiest thing to do.
It is the easiest thing. We will look, we're not going to talk about it. Any of the authors listening to this, we're probably not going to speak about every single story.
No.
Because there's about 22 in the first and about 12 or 13.
And that would be boring and repetitive.
Yes, it would be. But, yeah, look... Steampunk is not my kettle of fish, and there was a point about halfway through The Sea Is Ours, where if I'd heard of another dirigible and or mechanic item...
It was the mechanical things that were starting
so
to...
So it wasn't just you? It wasn't just me, sorry, it was you as...
Yeah, and again, I don't think steampunk is really my bag, and I was hoping that this particular anthology would dispense with a lot of the, philosophical issues I have with steampunk.
This is the brilliance, well, or not, as the case may be. If you have a steampunk anthologies at the moment, not that I read them, but you'll find...
Speaking
from no authority and totally generalising...
Yep.
We'll have one or two or three stories in them that will try and subvert, undermine, or something of steampunk as a genre, as I understand it, from what I've been told.
Well, I think almost any good anthology should do that.
But this anthology is trying to recast the main protagonists and the main and where these sort of stories are set, rather than trying to, and that's its form of subversion. It's saying that it's not going to have lots of white people, and it's not going to be set in America or England. It's going to be set in Southeast Asia, but keep the same basic tools of steampunk. So it's not trying to subvert it by doing something weird and one by doing a story that sort of has the steampunk gloss, but it's subverting the whole genre. It wants to keep the tools of the genre, just put them somewhere else.
Yeah, no, I see. Yeah, no, I understand.
So,
is in itself a very important thing to do.
Yeah, but after a while, it starts to, and it's not because, it's also partly.
It's possibly not an anthology that should be read in, a single or even double sitting, which both of us probably. Like, I don't think we read a couple of stories and then went away and read another book, right? We read the book.
Yes.
Yeah, from start to finish.
But because
in fairly quick succession.
There was variety in Afro-SF, because it's just Africa, essentially, that African writers in Africa. Although there's still sameness in that too, because a lot of the same themes pop up.
Yeah, yeah.
Bureaucracy, crazy bureaucracy.
And, well, yeah, sort
and
of
And medicine,
the,
health.
Yeah, and the futility in a lot of the stories of actually doing anything about the unfair Kafkaesque sort of bureaucracy and government structures that are in play.
Correct.
And that was, it was quite disheartening actually, because a lot of the stories, except for the last story,
which was Proposition 23.
Yes. And that was the same sort of, government doing evil things, in this case, an AI.
Yep.
wanting to sort of enslave humanity, I guess, and do their own stuff.
I really love that story.
But there was stuff happening in that. Like the people were doing something and it ended on a note of change, yeah. Whereas a lot of the other stories that were dealing with that theme didn't.
No.
They ended on a note of futility and I guess understandable, but still self-interest.
Like Home Affairs by Sarah Lotz, which...
And Terms and Conditions and...
Yes, Terms and Conditions, yeah, that's another
one. There was a whole bunch that dealt with this sort of stuff, the trial, and it's, you know, the stories are quite, frustrating to read, not as because of the stories, but because of the content, right? And it's quite frustrating and unfair and you... But they kind of just stayed there and ended like that, which I guess is a point to make that sometimes there is nothing you can do. But it just seemed to be a point that was made over and over in this.
What's interesting is that bureaucracy is international. It's not specific to countries, but there's bureaucracy everywhere. I work for the bureaucracy.
Evil.
I know. But you find, and again, I'm gross generalization, but in Western stories, bureaucracy is played fun of.
I think it is in this too.
No, but it's life and death to a degree.
But it's still like one of the interesting things about this anthology was, and at times it was, at times it didn't work. It was discordant. But a lot of the stories had this thick vein of humour running through the stories, even when they were about hideous bureaucracies.
But the trial is literally life and death.
Yeah, it is, and yet there's this dark humour that runs through it.
Yeah, it's a good story, though. Yeah. I should mention that the trial's written by Joan Delahaye.
Yeah.
But the point I'm making is that
it is a good,
your Western bureaucracy stories, unless they're hyper-real, they're usually poking fun. Yes, there might be some poking funny, but the Sarah Lodz one is bloody disturbing. It's in how it plays around with privilege as well and all sorts of other things, but it's really, really disturbing. It's not funny.
No, but it's written in a humor. I mean, there are jokes in it. It's written in a funny way. The tone is humorous, which is where I think, I didn't particularly like that story, I think, because it did have a very flat ending. You know, this woman fixed her own problem quite easily, as it turns out. And that's where the story ends.
But I think that was the commentary on privilege, that because she was a person who was wealthy or relatively wealthy, she could find a solution to her problem, but others can't. I mean, that scene where in that story where she's walking through the – well, first off, she's there. The basic context is she's lining up like at a –
Centrelink, Department of Social Security.
Yeah, to have something done for her. What it is – I mean, it's in the story, but it's not relevant to this discussion. Anyway, but because of a fight that goes on at the Centrelink – With the automated tellers, she ends – the floor literally opens up from below her and she gets chucked into the lower levels. Yeah.
Tell me that's not funny.
It is funny, but it's also quite scary because it's dark. There's nothing on. She finds her way out.
Yeah,
and then finds that she's now person non grata. These automated teller machines won't
recognize her. Because they've wiped her identification number, and therefore she can't. Yeah,
and it galls her because she's someone who's actually got money, is privileged to a degree, and just this concept that she's now a non person is horrible. And then she finds there's a way to fix it, but in going to that, finding that way, she walks past, and there's this scene where she's in walking down a corridor, walking towards the place where she'll get this problem fixed. And there's all these people who can't afford it.
Yeah.
And I thought that was the point, that, yes, her problem is fixed.
Yeah.
But this is a systemic issue.
I felt like as a...
If it was on the nose?
I just thought the narrative arc and the emotional arc of the... Like, they kind of didn't go with it. Anywhere.
I disagree.
You know, it felt a bit flat to me. And and also it's like, it's quite obvious. Like, here's a horrible situation. Yes, it's a horrible situation. And like, I don't know. I just expected a bit more from the ending than other than that. Okay, my problem's fixed.
We can disagree.
Of course we can.
I mean, you are wrong here, but it's we can disagree. So the other thing is that runs through AfroSF, I think, is the medical bioengineered nanotechnology, but all around medicine and health and the struggle to be healthy in Africa, which sounds a bit terrible to say that, but it is a concern.
It's also the inequality
yeah.
between the classes, and that runs through the whole anthology again. So people who can afford things versus people who can't, and what happens to them as, in a lot of stories, non-citizens or non-persons, because they're the wrong type of person for various reasons. You know, this is the stuff that science fiction talks about.
It is the stuff that science fiction talks about, but it's there's look, I actually found a number of these stories quite upsetting and disturbing in that, look, I mean, how do you talk about this without sounding like a dickhead?
Go for it.
Because, I mean,
find out.
Well, yeah, I don't know, because we live in Western society. These are stories that mostly take place in Nigeria or South Africa, where obviously there are major gulfs in the economy and in terms of privilege and in terms of class, which exist here in Australia too, where we're podcasting from, but they're not
and
as
definitely definitely exist in America.
Where and definitely exist in America, and definitely exist in the Western world, yeah. But you know, aren't as overt as they're depicted in these stories. There you go. That's what I wanted to say.
You don't think the Flint water crisis in Michigan is pretty fucking overt?
What there is becomes an explosion of controversy and anger and fury, and something must be done. Not that it necessarily has been, but you know, it becomes a big story worldwide. The crimes and misdemeanors, and I'm being a bit silly here, but the crimes and misdemeanors that are depicted in this story seem to be just a way of life. So Flint, Michigan isn't a way of life for American citizens. It's a way of life for a number of the people in these stories.
Mm.
And that's the point, you know. So here am I, white guilt and all, saying – white Jewish guilt, I should say, saying – and that's a whole different scene. Saying, oh, these poor people and you know, they can't get their medicines, or they have to stand in line and there's an automated system that will pretend that they no longer exist, or
they're
part of gangs and there's all these.
Sure. But can I just interrupt you there?
Yeah, please do. Because I knew where I was going.
To point out that this is science fiction. These stories don't depict, you know, Nigeria and South Africa and other nations as they are now.
No, but they extrapolate where they're heading.
Yeah, but
it's not happy where they're heading.
No, well, I don't think it's happy where most of Western civilization is heading either, quite frankly.
You have a point there. I mean,
saying before, it sounded like you're going, oh, my God, this is what Africa is like. And it's clearly not. I mean, this is science fiction, and it's an extrapolation as much as, Kafka's The Trial or George Orwell's 1984 or Cory Doctorow's Little Brother, or any number of stories that we tell in science fiction about, you know, corrupt governments and the automation, centralization of government services and security forces, and how people become numbers, and the escalating poverty gap. I mean, you know, a lot of this stuff, it is happening now. It is happening in Western societies. I mean, the American health system is appalling. Our Australian health system is hopefully not going to go the same way, but no thanks to our current government. The departments of social securities, including in Australia, are doing terrible things to the people who require their services in the name of conformity and austerity and cost cutting. And people are becoming numbers, and people are getting booted out of the system for no reason whatsoever. I mean, you know, there's legislation in Australia set to go through next month which will give private profit-motivated job companies the ability to fine the people they're meant to be helping if they don't, I don't know, turn up for an interview on time or present well for them. So, I mean, you know, this is not just Africa that you can extrapolate forward without too much effort. This is capitalism in motion. And that's me on my socialist soapbox.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
But I mean, that's not to say that I'm also not saying that, well, African SF is just SF and there's no difference between anything, because there is. There's clearly thematic and tonal differences in this anthology. That
okay, so what are
quite
they?
Different? Well, some of the melding that I was saying in tones, which I originally found quite jarring. So the stories, which as you were saying before, have really, you know, on the face of it, quite horrific content about what happens to people, but are written in almost a lighthearted manner. And I would say the Sarah Lott story is one of those.
Okay.
And if not lighthearted, certainly matter of fact, with a good dose of black humour, which I think
There's an inevitability to some of the tone.
Yeah, I mean,
shit happens.
The inevitability is one of the things I found really depressing. Yeah, and that was in the trial. That was in I can't remember the name, but the story about supers and regulars, where
the one that feels like it's a chapter from a bigger novel.
Oh, I didn't. I don't know if we're talking about the same story. But the one where the women are matched with the supermen who get to control.
Oh, them, yes.
There's all this sort of stuff. Yeah, so I don't know that you necessarily get that tonal juxtaposition in a lot of Western stories. And again, generalisation, obviously. But yeah, perhaps we tend to be more focused in our tone, and unless we're writing a humorous story, less likely to put humour into a really dark, sort of dystopic.
So we've spoken generally about this particular collection. Were there particular stories you liked? I hope there were, because otherwise it's going to be pretty depressing. No, because I was going to say the one that I liked the one that just blew me away. There were two actually. Well, there were three for me. But you want to jump in? Because
I'm just waiting for you to give me a gap. I really like To Gaze Into the Sun, or To Gaze at the Sun, which was about the people who are given augmented or android young men to have as sons for a couple of years before they go off to serve in the military and mostly die. And it's a look at these sons as not actual children that you raise, but it's almost a status symbol that you would have a son that you can then sacrifice to the army. Even though they're not your son, they've been allocated to you.
Oh, yes. And I'm sorry. I've got my note here saying that this is a brilliant story, and it is.
It is. I really, really liked it. And
it's by Clifton. This is the one by Clifton Gachagar.
Yeah, and I really did like it. I liked how it played with the idea of family and status, and in a world where clearly natural children are not that common.
No, natural children aren't common, and children are essentially a commodity.
Well, sons are a commodity.
Sons are a commodity.
To sacrifice to the nation to go to war. Like, it's a very specific social transaction that you're making. You're getting a young man, about 17 or so, for a couple of years to be your son, who you're meant to care about as a son, though, they aren't really a son. And so you get to then sacrifice your son. Yeah, it's a really interesting world, and it's quite lightly done, which is not the case for all the stories, unfortunately. There's quite a lot of info dumping in a lot of them. But the information in this story was, I think, spread out quite well.
It has these moments of sheer horror where the son, in this particular one, is just thinking, well, should I kill my parents?
Yeah, because he hasn't quite, his rewriting hasn't quite worked.
Yes.
Like, he's died and he's been made into this thing, and all his memories are meant to be wiped so he can go back out into the world. But they left some in there, the bits that made him a good soldier, but they've also then inadvertently left other bits in that makes him smell flowers and look at the sun.
So he's his odd.
That he's not meant to do. He's not meant to sleep, and he sleeps.
Yeah.
Presumably one thinks to dream.
And therefore has these offhand thoughts about killing his parents.
Yeah.
Which just, it's a great.
I really like that story.
No, I agree with you. It's fantastic. It's an awesome story.
Another one I really liked, I did actually like Terms and Conditions Apply, which was the one about the regulars and the supers, and I thought that was a really horrible story. But the voice and the tone in that was really kind of spot on. It was this point of view character who's in an awful situation, but who is leavening her situation that she can't get out of with this kind of wry cynicism and humour.
Is that how you took that story?
Yeah.
It's bloody disturbing.
It's really disturbing. But that's what I mean about the juxtaposition of tone. You know, she's in this terrible situation that she can't get out of, that she has no way of getting out of, so she deals. And I thought, In that story, that tone was, and the voice was spot on. Because, yeah.
You made a comment, I don't know if it was on Mike, maybe it wasn't, maybe it was on the card trip here, that women don't get, they get treated pretty poorly, women generally in the stories.
Yeah, and this was one of the things, like it always.
And this is one of those stories
it
where.
It is, yeah. Look, and as a whole, as.
Because we should point out the supers, who are
a man, men, and the regulars.
Regulars are women.
Basically kind of sex slaves.
Basically, and, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And when supers
have sex. And
it's not
the only story that has sex slaves for women as sex slaves.
Well, when supers have sex with their sex slaves, it's obviously not particularly complicit.
And often
it's brutal,
physically damaging.
Correctly.
Yeah.
Correct. Correctly.
But no,
correct.
I think, and one of the things that does, I guess it's become kind of a thing that I pick up on now. Taken, not any one of these stories for the most part, except for the one which decides to blame this horrible conflagration which kills everyone on, you know, being caused by this, I think, quote, silly and beautiful young woman or silly and beautiful girl.
Which story was that?
Oh, the one
that?
About the sex industry and the women who work and have food put all over them. And Brandy City?
Yep.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, really? Really? I don't know if that was meant to be read with irony or not, but I didn't think it was. But anyway, what was I saying? Oh, yeah. So as a whole, like none of these stories in themselves are a problem. But taken all together, again, you have this multifaceted depiction of a future where misogyny is still rampant. Women are still treated like sexual objects and objects of conquest and possessions. And even when they're not, they're disrespected and their authority is not taken seriously. And all of this stuff. And it's like, really, even in a couple hundred years in the future, we still, you know, it's depressing. It's depressing as fuck. I think we had this conversation around China Miéville's book, Embassy Town, because he did not do that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's
Christ, that was a lot of podcasts ago.
I know, right? That's kind of the takeaway. It's like really, and as I said, like each one of these stories are kind of, I guess, pointing at this saying, look bad, which, yeah, we know, hopefully, most of us. And where are the stories where it doesn't matter that women are in positions of power?
So why does terms and condition work then?
Oh, no, I'm not saying it didn't do that. I'm saying like you know, the individual stories can work or not work. I'm just saying building the bigger picture that this anthology does, that's the picture. And it's depressing as hell. Like it really is. I want more stories where this isn't an issue. And it's not because it's not an issue now. Of course it's an issue now. But sometimes you just want to see an imagined future where it's not an issue. And it's not even a non-issue to be kind of pointed at and go, hey, look how it's not an issue. It's just not there.
Yeah, it's
and that
yeah.
would be really refreshing.
Yeah.
And again, it like Afro-SF is not the only anthology by any means to do this. It's just, yeah, a note and that it's
talking more positively about the collection because yes. we were talking about our favourite stories and, of course, you had to go and ruin it by being serious. Planet X.
Oh, is that one where they kill God?
No.
No? Oh, no, no. So, oh, yes, no, I loved Planet X, where the aliens, and there's this massive paranoia about aliens who may or may not be there, and you're not sure as a reader whether they're aliens or whether people have just gone batshit. And
so basically the Russians
find a
planet near Pluto or something.
On the outskirts. Yeah. It was hidden by Pluto.
And then within seconds even, this is used as a reason to blame, you know, it's the aliens
it's
that
the
did
aliens.
It.
Yeah.
And it just rang so true.
Yeah, and the lynch mobs and the paranoia that runs through, is it Cape Town that one's set in? Yeah.
But it's also, again, like you were saying before, quite funny.
It is funny until the very end, and then it's not funny. And it's like, ugh. But the ending is really good. I think the note that story finishes on is really strong. Like it's subtle, but it's a really strong ending.
Which is?
Oh, I don't want to spoil it. It's like it's a really good story.
Yeah, that was right up there as one of my favourites. And the other one is Heresy. That is the one.
Where they kill God.
Where they kill
God. Yeah, I know it's funny and it's not meant to be taken seriously.
But you see, collections need stories like that.
I know. And it's just not my cup of tea.
It is entirely my cup of tea. It is absolutely my cup of tea because that's an author who's, and I should probably mention who the author is and I will find out, Mandisi Nkomo. And by the way, the author of Planet X is S.A. Partridge. So I'm laughing now. I mean, look, I read this 2 weeks ago and Heresy and Planet X and Heresy both stuck there. And Heresy, just the complete insanity of it that you have, you know, the Chinese government is now basically America in this world. They've become the capitalists. Is it South Africa essentially now
It's South Africa, this one. Yeah.
South Africa have now become – shows how much it stuck with me, how well I know the plot details. South Africa have sort of become the North Korean archetype in that, you know, and all of this is about this sort of Star Trek type idea where you get to the edge of the galaxy or the edge of our solar system.
Yeah, the edge of our solar system.
And you poke a hole in this screen that – this glass, opaque glass that happens to be there. You poke a hole in it
And there's heaven.
And there's heaven.
Because it literally is just a solar system. That's all that exists. Everything else is a
Everything's been illusion. An illusion. All the other planets, stars.
And I guess that's where I just stepped off.
It's
and
hilarious.
Went, I know. And I thought,
but it goes further, isn't it? Just that. It's oh, and by the way, we've killed God. Yes. That would appear. And it's just, I love.
And then we'll use that by saying, well, if there is no God now, because, you know, empirically we found it and we've killed it, well, then you have to turn to us to save you.
Correct.
So it's, yeah.
I mean, and at the same time, this sort of North Korean analog in South Africa, they're just killing all the scientists who are saying things that, you know, there are death squads going around. It's this extremely disturbing story as well, which also happens to be very funny and silly. And I don't know, it's just this perfect little thing.
Perfect little Ian story.
It's better than just a little Ian story.
Not so much for me.
What, because it doesn't have...
It's just, I...
It's too surreal.
It's not, well, it's not the surreal, I guess it's the ludicrousness of it. And it's just, yeah, it's not my kind of story, and that's fine.
Okay, fine.
I'm allowed to not have stories I like.
But, you know, look, I've got to say that for me, heresy... Oh, and the other story that I thought was awesome, so I'm now getting all excited, is Tade Thompson's story, Notes from Gethsemane. Which
one was that?
Well, it's the one about...
I'm really bad with titles.
No, that's all right. It's the one that involves gangs, but has a pit in it, and they go...
And the pit's alive?
Yeah, basically, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Look, this was...
The pit's alive.
That's what they say. Like, not something in the pit, but the pit itself is alive and sentient and wants to communicate.
Basically, a brother... This is the one with two brothers... a brother is doing a job for the gang that his other brother runs or is high up in, and he's to send a message and a package. It's a package to
a courier drops a package basically, and it needs to be picked up.
And it all connects to this pit where the pit itself is sentient, but stuff in the pit makes you sick and kills you, and it's quite grisly and gory. But I thought. I love the writing. It just got me. It engaged me.
I think this was one of those stories, and there were a few of them. And don't ask me to list them.
I'm going to ask you to list them.
No.
Okay.
Where I don't know. I just thought it just didn't stick the ending. The ending was just too. I don't know. Too neat or too pat or too something, and quite a few of them kind of did that. I thought. I thought Claws and Savages had a problem with how it ended. And Au Fait, the one about the people.
No, see, Au Fait, that's the one. That's the one that is basically a chapter of a larger novel.
Yeah.
It's a superhero story.
Things were too neat. Like a lot of
there was nothing neat in Au Fait. It's a superhero story where it takes place in a party.
Yeah.
And you feel like – and there are all these dangling threads that are never resolved.
But that's what I mean. Like this, like some of these stories kind of – they have a story and everything – you know, it's just trajectory of the story and they just all follow the trajectory and things happen because they need to for the story. And I think Au Fait or Au Fait was one of those. And, yeah, it doesn't – I don't know. You kind of get to the end of it and it's like, end?
I don't know. Yeah. I think the Notes from Gethsemane does stick the landing because there's an arc about two brothers in amongst all this, and one brother being smarter than the other and wanting more for himself, and how that connects to the pit and all that. Yeah, maybe it's a bit convenient and a bit artificial, but
I just think a lot of these, not a lot of them, but some of these stories, they could have, I don't know, had a bit more meat on the bone, I guess.
Yeah, okay, all right, we'll leave it at that.
And I think that, like, one thing I want to say, and I do feel kind of bad about it, you know, because it is a small press anthology and so on, so we never like to kick puppies, but I thought this anthology, Afro-SF, it really needed a good edit. There was... So just on a text level, there were so many, you know, comma splices and missing hyphens and misplaced semicolons and contextual ambiguities that, you know, sentences just needed to be rewritten. And, yeah, I just it's a shame. I think it really needed a proper line edit going through it. And also some of, like, a structural edit in some places to get rid of, you know, there were some places, again, I'm not going to go through and name names and stuff, but, you know, where characters would say something and then you'd it'd be explained to you what they were thinking while they said it, when it was quite obvious.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you know, like a lot of that sort of stuff that, like, a really good editor can go through and winnow out and make everything a stronger story. You don't need to explain characters' thoughts a lot of the time because you've done it with what they've said or done. You don't need to, say the same thing two or three times throughout a story. There were some problems with some stories where information felt...
And I don't know if it was your copy or mine, but there were some places where the italics had underlines rather than italics.
There was one story that had underlines
It was the Nick Wood story.
Yeah, and I don't know whether that was
messy editing or...
I know, I don't know. It didn't make any sense to me why, because there were a couple of instances of italics in that story, which then made me think, oh, the underline is there for a reason, but I didn't know what the reason was. So I do think this was not edited well on a at the most basic copy edit level. It really needed another couple of passes to tighten up a lot of these stories, and it's a shame because a lot of these authors there were several authors where it said in the notes that this was their first.
I will tell you how many because I counted.
Their first publication.
Do you want me to tell you?
Sure. You have a handwritten spreadsheet. That's impressive.
it was about five authors of the 22 that had their stories.
So it's first publication.
Yeah. Yeah.
And some of the other authors, judging by the bio, they're not extensively published, so they're still emerging authors. And it is a shame to see stories that could have been tightened a lot more and made a lot better debut in some cases than what we have on the page. And I know a lot of readers don't care.
I'll be honest, other than that Nick Wood thing with the italics, I missed a lot of that.
Yeah.
What I didn't miss is what you've said, which is the old piece of dialogue that's then repeated in text literally 2 minutes later, exposition, which does occur in a bunch of these stories.
And
that I didn't. Semicolons being in the wrong spot, I wouldn't know where to put a semicolon anyway. So I've no good with just read my reviews on my blog and you'll see I've no idea how to use semicolons.
But
I really can't knock someone on that. But no, that's not true. I don't know, but I expect the editor to.
That's it. It's a level when you edit a book, when you publish a book, there is a level of expertise I think that's required. I think, you know, and I'm not saying that that's what this particular editor thought, but I'm saying, you know, you wonder, a lot of people go, I'm just going to edit a book, and it means collecting the stories and doing a spell check. Editing is a really specialized.
Well, look, I don't know. I don't know Ivor Hartmann. This is the first thing of his that he's edited that I've read. His publishing company Storytime has been around since 2007. So, and it produces now annual anthology. So it's something he does.
on a craft level and a line level, this is in no way comparable to the House of Small Shadows that I talked about. This is much better, which says a lot because this is a small press. And this is why I feel bad saying these things, because it is a small press. You know, it's not a big publishing house that has, you know, editors and copy editors and proofreaders at their disposal, which is why you expect a lot more of a mass-produced book and you're a lot harsher on it, right?
That Adam Neville book, that's
itched. Stuck with me, dude. It's like the trauma. I'm not going to get over it. And you know, the prose here is fine. It's just it could be better. And there's a lot of frequent, and I'm talking about almost on a page level, frequent, you know, mistakes about grammar and punctuation that did at times made it difficult to read. There were things I had to pass a couple of times because there was an ambiguity because of the way a sentence was structured or a word was used.
Not to have the most clumsiest segue of all time, but The Sea Is Ours. Did it have the same issues? That's published by Rosarium.
Not to the same extent. There were minor things, but you always get some things. Okay. And so, not on a copy edit basis. No, in terms of how everything was kind of on the page, it was much better. I think there were still stories which had some structural issues that could have been honed a little more. But this can come down to editorial taste.
So I'm going to say, and I've already foreshadowed this earlier on the podcast. Yeah. I'm going to say it right now. There's only two stories in this collection that I liked.
Oh, that's sad.
It's not the I'm not the
that
audience.
That is a steampunk anthology.
I'm not the audience. And, no. And part of the problem.
Actually, before you do, can we just, because I meant to read these two bits out at the beginning. So in the middle, that's as good a place as any as we move from one to the other.
Yeah, I'm about to, you know, say something terrible and you want to jump in. Okay, go ahead.
No, I think I'll do that. Is that I just wanted to read out a couple of extracts from each of the introductions, actually, now that we're talking about both anthologies,
which I
guess is their mission statement in a way.
Yep.
But I think they're really important concepts to think about when we're looking at two explicitly non-Western anthologies that are yet aimed at Western readers to a certain extent. So I'm just going to read this small paragraph from Afro-SF, and this is what Ivor Hartmann is saying as one of the reasons he put this anthology together and wanted to produce this particular book. Sci-fi is the only genre that enables African writers to envision a future from our African perspective. Moreover, it does this in a way that is not purely academic and so provides a vision that is readily understandable through a fictional context. The value of this envisioning for any third world country, or in our case continent, cannot be overstated or negated. If you can't see and relay an understandable vision of the future, your future will be co-opted by someone else's vision, one that will not necessarily have your best interests at heart. Oh, that's a cracker of a mission statement.
And I don't know if the book meets it.
Well, it meets it in the very basic but very significant sense that it is writing futuristic fiction from an African perspective. And if that's all it did, that would be a very significant thing.
True. No, fair point. Yep.
You know, because let's face it, our science fiction, as we know and love and are sometimes infuriated by the genre, is very white and very Americanized. So to read science fiction that isn't and is talking about different people and different settings, and even at the very base level of different names and different words in an English language story, is refreshing and is important.
I have a rant about this.
Okay, go
but
for
I
it.
Want you to read out. No, I want you to read
oh,
out.
Oh, okay. So I want to complement that with, I guess, the similar kind of rationale for The Sea is Ours. So this is from the introduction written by Jamie Goh and Joyce Chang. In our iteration of steampunk, neo-Victorianism and all its attendant issues are optional, even sidelined, as we push back against the idea that we must acknowledge the superiority of the British Empire. Steampunk, in our anthology, is an aesthetic that combines retrofuturism, alternate history and techno-fantasy, so we wanted to know what did these elements look like from a Southeast Asian perspective. And I'm skipping a little. It was, and still is, imperative that we have volumes dedicated to our own voices, projects not of post-colonial melancholia, but of decolonial determination. I love that phrase.
Yes, that is very good. And actually,
it does position where these stories are coming from.
Yes, absolutely.
This isn't about, oh.
Well, it goes back to what I said earlier.
Yeah.
This is about taking out the colonial, British colonial aspect, but keeping the basic.
Well, there was a lot of Spanish colonial material in the book, being Southeast Asia.
Yep, that too. And keeping though the aesthetic as said there.
But that's an important difference. This is not a post-colonial anthology. This is not an anthology that is mournful and melancholic and looking back and saying how terrible, which all true and valid. But this is doing this other thing.
Yes.
This is decolonizing, you know, in an imaginative way, in an alternate history way that steampunk belongs to as a genre.
It's repositioning steampunk.
So it's a way of,
realigning, repositioning.
Decolonializing. Yeah, it's a great, great word. So I just wanted to read out, I guess, those two rationales.
Can you go back again? Just read out those last couple of sentences again.
It was and still is imperative that we have volumes dedicated to our own voices.
There. Our own voices. Keep going.
Projects not of post-colonial melancholia, but of decolonial determination.
But projects of our own voices. And it's the same with the Hartmann as well. Mm-hmm. And I know I was about to talk about the two stories I liked in The Sea is Ours, but I thought, you know, now that you've brought
derailing.
Here's my thing. Okay.
Yes, here's your thing. Have your rant.
It's not really a very good rant. I thought about it at length over last week. And I still really haven't come to any conclusions. But so I did a count. There's 34 authors.
Handwritten spreadsheets.
Yeah, I really literally, and they're done on.
There's this little software program called Excel. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Look, for work-related reasons, I can't explain why I've done it this way.
Okay? Anyway, go ahead.
But anyway, 34 writers, 22 in one anthology, 12 in the other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I personally, and I make this a personal experience, okay? Yes. I personally heard of two of the writers.
Okay.
They are Nnedi Okorafor and Sarah Lotz, who happen to be the first two writers.
But you said you heard of Tadi Thompson as well.
Only I had to consider this by the fact that this was published in late 2012.
Okay.
And if I'd read it in 2013, I wouldn't have known of Tadi Thompson. Sure. I now know of him because he's been just recently nominated for a Kitschy Award. Making Wolf, I think, is the novel he got nominated for. Okay. So I haven't heard. So the first reaction to that is, isn't that great? 34 writers, 32 I know nothing about. Here's all these new voices I get to experience for the first time.
And I would be at about the same ratio, two or three, I think. Okay. Yeah.
And then a part of me goes, wait a moment. If I picked up any, I'm going to say, Western anthology at the moment, there is no way in hell that I wouldn't know. Even the smallest of small presses, if it's basically focusing on the general, and I'm talking science fiction fantasy here.
Yep.
I doubt very much that I would have such a bad hit rate in...
You'd know at least half, I would think.
I would think at least half.
And possibly most of the ones you didn't know might be debut authors.
Now... Yeah, that's
you may
right.
not have read them, but you'd know the names.
Correct.
Is what you're saying.
And and that's why I did a count on how many debut authors were in. At least it was hard to tell with the Afro. So not the Afro SF, the other one, the
Caesars.
But with the Afro SF, it was clear there was about six. So it's not a good chunk, but it's still 16 authors who have done other things. So look, okay, I read quite a lot in the genre. I like to think of myself as someone who knows a good chunk of writers. Obviously, I don't know everyone because that's crazy talk.
Yes.
So I read wide, but I read novels.
Yeah.
So I also did a count. How many of these authors have actually written a novel?
Not many.
Buckley's and Nunn.
Oh, no, that's not true. There were a few
that
had
novels. I'm exaggerating for the point of effect because you said not many. I thought, oh, just exaggerate.
Yes.
Look, again, hard to tell with C as ours, but from what I could gather, and again, I did only so much research, it was zero.
Okay.
And that was basically looking at their author bios at the end of the book, because I would have assumed at least if they'd written a novel. Because
it should be in there.
It should say, have written a novel. Now, it's possible I'm wrong and that they have written novels. But
then that's a really bad bio if they've written a novel and not put it in the bio.
Correct. In regards to Afro-SF, the number of a novelist was six. So six of them had written novels.
Okay.
Now, this is where it gets a bit sensitive. Of those six, two of them are people of colour.
Yep.
Okay, which I know is an American term, but still. And one of those was published after the publication of this book.
Okay.
That's the Tadi Thompson. So really, in a sense, it's one. And the other four were the whites. Because Afro-SF, of course, has a mix of white African writers and black African or African-American. African-American. Has a mix of white African. And white. Has a mix
white
of
and non-white.
White and non-white writers.
Let's say that.
Has a mix of white and non-white writers, of which four of them had written novels, although I noted that it seemed that those novels were mostly published in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So again, not exactly.
So what's your big point? I'm just going to reel you in.
No, I've got another. This is John Oliver style. I've got another 25 minutes. I'm kidding.
So not John Oliver style.
So here's the thing. So a lot of the books I read are published by Gallants, Orbit, Tor, those sorts of guys. And even if you look at the forthcoming books coming for this year, these sorts of authors are not being published for novels.
Yep.
So here's this project, both of them, both about encouraging voices we've not heard of, encouraging these new voices. Mm-hmm. But what's the end game? Because in 10 years, are we going to see more anthologies like this that are doing exactly the same thing? And the authors that we talked about in 2013 and 2015, they still haven't published novels. They still haven't been heard beyond these anthologies. They still haven't had any traction in the wider Western community. They're not being published by Tor. They're not being published by Gallants. They're not being published by Orbit or any of the other main publishers. Yes, they may get some, like Tadi Thompson's book is Rosarium. The publishers of The Sea Is Ours have published his book.
Oh, nice.
Now, isn't it great? The Kitschies picked that up. Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's why I love the Kitschies Awards
so much.
Well,
this is what one would hope would happen.
But
we're
the mainstream. But does it though? This is the point.
Well, I don't know because we can't see the future from this where we are.
No, but we're in 2016. This is not the first iteration of these sorts of anthologies.
No,
they have been around. This sort of, and I'm not having a crack at these anthologies, but this where we look at a marginalised group and see works from that marginalised group. Can I name them off the top of my head? No, I can't. But, you know, we are seeing...
No, and I would also be interested to know, because I'm not saying that these are the first, but a lot of the anthologies that we do get that are, yes, you know, stories from Nigeria, stories from the Philippines, stories from the thing that come out of Western publishing houses and are marketed to Western readers are often put together by Western editors.
That's right.
So, like, it is significant that both of these books are put, like, they're put together in-house, so to speak, right?
That's right.
These are books that came out of and were edited by and put together and by the people in the region that they're wanting to promote.
And the end of my rant is essentially that of 62 genre novels that were awarded or nominated for an award last year,
mm-hmm.
five of them were by non-white writers. That's pretty fucking awful.
It is under pretty any fucking metric. Awful.
And now, yeah. So the question I'm asking is, and it is a question, it's not one of those questions where I know the answer, I'm just not going to say it, is do these anthologies actually help?
I don't know the answer either.
Oh, no, neither
and
do I.
And I hope they do, and all I can say is that we can't see the future. And I would hope that anthologies like these and that more get done
But they've got to be done by, and all respect to Rosarium and Storytime, but they've got to be done by slightly larger outfits.
But they won't be because...
But Ian,
the publishing houses these days don't publish books like this.
True, that's true.
Right?
That's true.
Like, I'm not saying like non-Western books. I'm saying anthologies, short story collections. They're not the concern of big mass market publishers.
And we do have...
They're not. We publish novels. That's what we publish in the West. That's what we award.
And the Lightspeed Gang are doing things like, you know, Queer People Killed SF and People of Colour have killed, which I just, you know, was a Kickstarter just recently, People of Colour Killed SF. So they're coming out. But what is the effect? What is the actual qualitative, quantitative, whatever effect of these pieces of work? Are they just, wow, look, we all feel better now because we've now just read this, being really cynical about it.
I can tick my diversity box for my reading this year.
I had not heard of 32 authors.
No, and look,
I should have heard of more of them, is what I'm saying.
But that's why these books are here.
Yeah, I know.
Because we haven't heard of them.
It's a chicken and egg situation, right? Like
these books are here to introduce these different voices and different authors.
But what I'm saying is it feels like there should have been a decade, that this is the next generation of these writers that I'm being introduced to, and that there's a generation prior.
Yeah.
Who are already now in the mainstream and they're out there and we're seeing award books from them, you know, and so now we're seeing all this stuff.
But we're not.
We are not. It feels like we've just started. This is the beginning and it can't be the beginning because non-white writers have been writing in the genre for decades. How can this be? This can't be seen as the beginning. This has got to be, but it is though. That's the tragedy of this.
Okay. But you know what? If it's a beginning, it's a beginning.
I'm not saying don't do it. I'm not saying throw it out. I know
what you're saying. And I guess you would just hope that, as with a lot of, you know, short story publications from authors, that might be the beginning of getting into, I guess, the novel world. But that in itself is, I mean, I do have an issue with the fact that that the novel is regarded still
it is.
As the premier form.
But it is.
And it's
I'm sorry.
No, it is, but that's what I'm saying. So what happens to writers from any culture, but especially from cultures where novels aren't the actual mode of storytelling?
Frankly, in a non-white world, too bad.
Because
Harlan Ellison are anomalies.
Well, Harlan Ellison couldn't be Harlan Ellison if he started today, let's face it.
No.
You know, Ellison started his career at a time when, you know, along with Asimov and Heinlein and all those guys, when you could indeed make a living writing short stories if you wrote enough of them and got them published in decent markets.
These 34
right?
writers.
You can't do that.
These 34
days.
Writers need to be aiming for novels if they want their craft to be taken seriously.
And isn't that a problem in itself?
Abso-fucking-lutely. It's partly my point.
Yeah.
Too. That is partly my point, that the
so
novel
that
is the premier.
Issue.
Yes.
Absolutely. Because a lot of the inroads are being made in the short fiction arena in terms of bringing in diverse voices and different points of view
but
experimenting with form and all of that
But it doesn't seem to pass
sort of
that membrane
because
to novel.
don't regard anything except the novel as a proper form of literature worthy of consideration. Correct. Sorry, that's it.
Correct.
At the moment, that's it. If you don't write a novel, you're not a writer. Getting a few short stories published, getting 100 short stories published. No, sorry.
And because we're not going to fix this anytime soon, because that battle we can't fix, I don't think. I don't think we can suddenly turn the short story into a premier
piece.
We
could champion the mosaic.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Once an episode.
You could argue that Amazon with Kindle Shorts and things like that is starting to get that sort of thing
happening.
Yeah,
it might be, yeah.
And yeah, but I mean...
I don't know. I mean, look.
You look at the main literary awards, they don't look at short. I mean, there's the Edge Hill Prize. There are literary awards that specifically focus on short fiction, but they do not have the same cachet.
They're not the Booker. They're not the Orange. What's it called now? The
National Book Award, the Bailey's
fiction, the Stella, the Miles Franklin.
Whatever. The point is that for these writers, these 34 writers, yes, I know, this is an introduction to a whole new bunch of voices.
But, Tadae Thompson has a novel published since. I don't know. I have no idea, but maybe it...
I did a quick check.
This publication was part of the road to having that novel
possibly
published.
I did a quick check, but by a small press, Rosarian.
Yeah.
So...
I know. It's not good. I'm agreeing with you.
Not for the Kitschy Awards. Well done, Kitschy judges.
But if not for that award, I have no fucking clue he had published a book. But you can't keep saying if not. Because all the if nots are showing that slowly... incrementally, it is working, right? If not for the Kitschy Awards, but he did get nominated. An award, this is what I'm saying. If you discount all the things that are actually chipping away at the monolith that is the great white Western male novel, if you discount all of them and say, if not for, then what is left? You know, you have to count them. You have to celebrate them. You have to say, it's great. It's great that Tadae Thompson's novel got a Kitschy Award. It's great that, you know, that both of these collections are here and Afro-SF has a second volume out.
You're right. No, you're right. It's not fair to just say if not. I agree.
Yeah.
But that book, I think, came out in September 2015.
Which one?
The Making Wolf, the Tadae Thompson's novel. I saw very little. Again, I like to think that I'm connected. You know, I'm one of those connected types. I saw very little buzz about it. And again, short, small press publisher, you know, it's not going to get the buzz.
No, it's not. This is the ecosystem.
I'm saying, but thank God for the Kitschies.
Yeah, but this is the ecosystem that we're currently living in is, unfortunately, it is about award shortlists. Not because the awards themselves are necessarily, you know, the most crucial thing in a writer's career, but because they get you know, your name is there. You're noticed. You've seen the Thompson book. You know, reviews and prominent review sites are part of the ecosystem. All of there's millions, literally. You couldn't have said that a century ago or even 50 years ago, but there are literally millions of novels published every year from self-publishing right up to, you know, the latest blockbuster from a huge house like Hachette. Millions. You don't get to hear about even a small fraction of them.
All I'm concluding is, you're right, but all I'm concluding is, look, I'm not blaming awards for not picking more people of color, non-white writers.
You're going to blame them.
No, I'm not, because it's a bit like the Oscars so white, in that you've got to start with the product that's being produced. I mean, you can only – look. The debate goes – no, yes, of course you can blame – without getting into an Oscar discussion, because not really the podcast, but yeah, you can argue that Creed and Michael B. Jordan and Dope and a bunch of other African-American films that were done in that year should have been nominated for something. Absolutely. There was still product to pick from. It wasn't like there was nothing.
Yeah, there
was product. But the amount of product is a lot less. And the fact of the matter is when we go to...
But shouldn't that stand out then?
Okay.
It's a serious question. What is wrong with us in the West psychologically?
But that's the point I'm making.
Breaks the pattern... The things that should attract our attention because, oh, wait, that's different, are the things we actually just turn a blind eye to.
Yes. Yeah, okay.
You know?
Yeah, I furiously agree with you. That's terrible. But I'm making the point that the genre publishers out there, they need to take these anthologies, need to notice these anthologies first. Okay. Yeah. So the Tours, Tour.com, I'm not smacking them over there. Tour.com is publishing all sorts of variety of diverse people. I'm focusing on the novel here, though. The publishers, the mainstream publishers who publish novels, who are now part of much bigger publishing houses, the Big Five, whether it's Macmillan or Hachette or whatever, need to look at these anthologies and not just go, well, isn't that nice, it ticks a box. Who are these authors?
Yeah.
Because there's at least six or seven who in the Afro-SF who I'd, you know, I'd love to see a novel from.
Yeah. And, you know,
that's, maybe less, I think, so in the but see, is ours. Not that they're not competent, it's just I lost steam with that anthology.
Yeah,
yeah, I know. Brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah, look, I think it is a problem. I think the monopoly of the novel, and in particular the type of novel as well, it's not just the novel, it is a type of novel that is the highly commercial novel. It is publishing not wanting to take a lot of risks anymore. Big publishing, I mean. It is, you know, in a sense, a lot of the interesting work and the umbrella of interesting still, unfortunately, takes into account non-Western writing, because that's still interesting because we don't see a lot of it.
I thought you were going to say exotic there for a second.
No, you said that.
No, but that's that's the pejorative. That's interesting,
but
or
I
exotic.
Didn't use the pejorative because it's genuinely interesting. Because as I said, it breaks the pattern, and things that break the pattern should be attention catching. Clearly, they're not. But all of this work, I was starting to say, all of this work is being done in the small press. And if all this work is done in the small press and it's done well, hopefully some of those authors, and let's face it, most of the authors who get published in short fiction in Western anthologies are never going to go on and write a novel, and you'll never hear from them again, right? So it's not just, you know, it is an issue with short story writers.
No, but you feel like, again, coming back to the product, you feel like there's millions of them.
Yeah, there is millions of them.
There's a bigger, far bigger pool, yeah. Millions of them. So if few fall by the, well, if a few
if
hundred
a few
thousand
doesn't really matter.
Fall by the wayside, well, you know.
Sure, but what I'm saying is, like, you can't expect every author in every anthology.
I'm not expecting there to be a 50-50 yeah. split. And I'm not what I'm hoping is that someone were to look at a story by Timothy DeMicali on The Consequence of Sound, which is the opening story.
Yeah.
And it's, notice how I'm bringing it back to the collections. The opening story of The Sea is Ours.
Yeah, that was a really good story.
Beautiful story. Beautiful piece
kind of
writing.
Heart-wrenching.
Heart-wrenching. It's a beautiful story. It's a father-daughter story. It's just...
It's lovely.
Unfortunately, it set up a very high expectation for the rest of the anthology for me, because not many of the stories, except for the other one I really, really liked was the Olivia Ho Working Woman.
Not, yeah, that was fun.
A number of the stories, didn't match the beauty that just the sense of soul.
Oh, and that's nice.
The sense
yeah.
of, you know, that is in the On Consequence of Sound. But just Olivia Ho and Timothy DeMicali, if they're, you know, if that was it, I would be saying someone published these guys.
Mm. So I also really liked Robert Liao's story Spider Here, which was about, I know you didn't care for it in particular, but it's just about these kids who are making these little hybrid biomechanical spider bot things that use real spiders as the brains of the outfit, and having these little battles that they bet on, and it's this little story about these kids, but it's set in the background of an environment where there is terror and there is clearly some kind of colonial dynamic at play, and yet these kids are making this little world for themselves, and I really love the writing in it. I love the focus on the main character, who is she's the maker of a lot of these spider casings, as they call them. And I love how the story takes you through and like puts it such a narrow focus onto her, and that scene where she, after the bombing that happened and everyone got scared, and then she can't sleep and she gets up and she makes this brilliant new spider casing, because that's what she does. And that's how she copes. I loved it. I love that story so much. It was one of my favourite.
I'm not sure why I bounced off it so hard.
Yeah, I adored it. I really, really did.
Because I just found it. I found it quite boring.
More mechs that you were.
No. I just
more mechs.
Well, it's my maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. I
think I love the focus of it. I love the focus that was.
You've spoken so passionately
picture.
About it right then.
I feel like I need to go
and reread it.
I loved it. I thought the ending was just perfect. Yeah, it was a really great story. That was definitely one of my favourites.
And anything else?
Well, the two you mentioned I really liked.
Well, I just want to say, Olivia Ho, that one is this wonderful reworking of Frankenstein. It is.
That's
what
it
is. But it also has, you know,
this woman who's a mechanised bioweapon of sorts, who escapes or is stolen and then escapes.
Well, she and her others are in internment camps.
Because they're experimenting on or the hybridizing actual women
yes.
to become these biomech.
Yeah, so things. Right there, that's pretty.
It's pretty horrible.
Pretty horrible.
So you've got her story.
But she gets saved by an old woman who's.
Oh, she's not that old. She's not actually not that old. They call her a girl at some point.
Yeah,
because she's widowed. I think because she's widowed, you might want her to be old.
Yeah, sorry, I apologize.
But she's a toy maker.
Yeah, she's a toy maker. Just beautiful. And then
and she, like, I love that there's a phrase in there. I'm not going to quote it exactly, but it's something about how she just, you know, she, her husband was a toy maker and then he died and she sort of took over the business and she's so much better at it than him ever because she just, it just all speaks to her. The gears and the mechanics, it all just speaks to her.
It has that.
It's lovely.
Funnily enough, even though the mechanics stuff started to shat me after a while, the focus of it in this story and just that intricate focus, it just made it so beautiful and so wonderful.
Yeah.
And then, of course, through all that, you've got the mercenary for hire.
She's mercenary. I was trying to think of a word to describe it because she's not really an assassin, but she could be. She's not really a ninja, but she could be.
Brilliant character who just links all
the things. And she's been assigned to retrieve the weapon
of mass destruction.
Yeah. And in the end, it all kind of goes balls up. And
Quentin Tarantino style, nearly.
Yeah.
It's all pretty violent.
The people who sent Ning, who's the mercenary, to retrieve the other woman, don't want her anymore, so they're not going to pay her. And she ends up, like, the three of them. It's this wonderful story with these three women who, until this story, have led very disparate lives, kind of being forced into this situation where they need to cooperate with each other and make things work. And then it ends with them being this kind of little...
I would kill a novel for this.
Oh, my God, I would love a novel.
I hope...
I would love
someone,
to see.
I'm talking to – I look, I know we don't have thousands of listeners, but I'm hoping someone will turn Working Woman into – well, Olivia Ho will write it and that someone will publish a novel.
I really like that story a lot.
I'm actually getting a bit weepy just talking about it. I mean, no, it is great.
It really was. I loved it.
And even though, yes, I didn't like a good chunk of the stories, the fact that you get introduced to just a couple, two or three, and I really should reread the Robert Lowe's.
I'm
going to reread that.
It's a really sweet little story, and I don't mean that in any condescending way. It is a little story, but it's really important.
It's worth it just for that experience.
Yeah.
And that's why I got upset about – the novel side of things. And I know the novel, but I just, anyway.
I mean, this is the thing. I think what's, look, as you say, it's not something that you and I, Ian, are going to single or dual-handedly overthrow the you know, the majesty of the novel. But I do wish there was more attention paid.
I just want to, I did like as well the Kate.
Because most of these things can't be novels. They can't be novels.
No, I'm not saying they can
be.
You know,
but they're wonderful, like, when they show talent. When they work, they're wonderful short stories.
But they show talent, and that's patronising. Oh, you're so talented. But no, they show a writer
who's interesting.
But it's absolutely.
And has an interesting.
And has talent. And has a different voice. Yep. And has a different way of looking at things. And has a different tone because there is so much science fiction and fantasy written.
Yeah.
You could swipe all the white writers away and okay, yes, that's.
Not all of them.
Not all of them because I like some of them. And yeah, you could seriously. I mean, the Cato Osias or Osias, not the unmaking of the Caldra Amorosa.
Yeah, I like
is another
that.
Story that I
like
really that. Really
like. It's
liked.
A, just it's at its like all it is.
It's a revenge.
It's
story.
Just a revenge story.
It's a revenge.
Really, but it's so beautifully written.
Yeah.
The relationship of the four central characters is beautifully done.
Yeah, and how they take revenge is just great.
Because they're
– I write like three stories.
So there you go.
Yeah, I know.
And you need to reread Spider here.
There
are good stories in there and some
– And you like the insects and women sing together, the final story.
I did. I thought it was not – I didn't think it was a good choice to end the anthology on because it's really long and quite complex and – Yeah, it might have been better to end on a shorter, punchier kind of a story, but it's a good little novelette, and it's possibly a little too long, but I did like.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with you very slightly in that I'm going to agree and disagree.
Okay.
In that the anthology is slightly heavy loaded. It's front loaded with light, shorter stories.
Yeah.
And then as you get towards the end, the last two or three are quite long.
Yeah.
Which I found odd. I didn't understand. And that's probably why I start to get a bit of exhaustion because, which is, I know it sounds strange. It's only about a 75,000 word collection. But when you've got so many shorter stories and suddenly these longer ones, your brain has to.
And you balance a lot as an editor. You balance, you know, not just balancing length, although that should be a. an important consideration, but you are balancing tone and content and trying to get everything to work together. But yeah, I did think ending on that one was, but I like the story. I did like the story. It was another, it's a mother-daughter story, this one. And it's about, you know, these two, well, the mother and the daughter, so not two women, but a woman and a girl. And neither of them really fit or want to fit the mold that is laid out for them in the world. And yeah, it is really cool.
Did you like the Chamber of Souls?
Which one's that one? No, I'm really bad with titles. Oh, no, that's about the machine that keeps the souls in its chest.
Yes.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't like that one. I thought it was it's one of those stories where it was just way – it was so overly complicated in terms of what was going on. Yeah, no.
Yeah, I thought no, there was I, a – see, this is an example. Again, this is towards the end of the collection, yeah. And again, I'm losing –
And it was another really long story, and I didn't think it needed to be that long for what it was doing.
It is. Again, there's like the last three of the last four stories are all quite long. And I thought there was a really good idea at the core of it, but it loses, again, it loses momentum. It didn't do it for me.
Yeah, no, I wasn't a big fan of that one. I did like how it began. With the refugees and
yes.
And you know that was quite interesting, but yeah, I mean, look, there are nice bits in it though. There's actually I want to quote from that one story that I did not care for. I actually there was one of my favourite passages in the whole book though. So you know, it's not always
isn't that fascinating?
It is fascinating. So the quote I wanted to read was: this is about when the bulk of the story, like the bulk of the plot, is over, and this is at the end, and the point of view character is trying to fit in, and all the refugees are trying to fit in this new, very strange world that they're never going to fit into because it's run by these guardians who are not human, and you know. But the line that or the paragraph that I really liked is talking about the point of view character's mother, and it's a. Mother had fallen to using their titles, and already I could feel the language of our people slowly changing and the dialect of our rescuers intermingling with ours, usurping it. I sigh, feeling the disquiet within me simmering. But yeah.
Yeah, that's really nice.
Yeah, and you know, it's ironic considering we are reading it all in English.
Yeah, true. Because that story, the reason I mentioned it is because it's a story that I felt had so much potential.
Yeah, and it's things like that I really like talking about the, you know, being displaced and being in a new place and having the things that make you you and your culture yours slowly getting, you know, in some cases voluntarily eroded and supplanted.
Did you finish every story that you read, all 34?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, so did I.
Yeah, I finished them all because that's what I do, except with, you know,
no.
Infinite Jest.
I actively... I wanted to take note of any that I was going to finish them all anyway, yep. But I wanted to know any of them I would not have finished. I don't think there was any that I would have not have finished.
There were a couple, including that Chamber of Souls one, that I was getting a bit skimmy.
So you're saying, okay, so wait a sec. The bit that you quoted, which is at the end of the story. Yeah.
Oh, no, because I thought I finished it. Like, I can skim and still pay attention.
Okay, I can't do that. No, I don't, I cannot do that. I either read or I don't read. Yeah. It's binary for me.
Yeah, but so I don't know. I mean, I'm just trying to think. I think they're the ones that I really liked.
Okay. Well, look.
The one thing I didn't like about this one, and part of it was the artifact of, I guess, reading it as an E story. Yeah, the Sea Is Ours story was the illustrations. No, wait.
You mean the anthology or the?
Yeah, the anthology. Yeah, okay. Yeah, was the illustrations, and partly that was because when I was reading it, my illustrations came right at the end. Of a story, like right abutted up against the text.
Oh, okay.
So it looked like it was – sometimes you got like a line of text at the top of the page and then the illustration. So it almost looked like it was meant to be the illustration of the story that you just read. So that – but that's not a – that's just an artifact issue. But the problem was that a lot of those illustrations give away something of the story that I almost would have preferred them to be at the end. It's like, here's a story you read and here's an artist's impression. So, yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of the illustrations being in there. But, so I mean, that's really hard.
You weren't into the illustrations because some of them are quite beautiful.
They're really nice. But, yeah, I mean, look, and often I guess it's a problem. I don't know. I'm not a visual artist, but I'd imagine that sometimes the most dramatic thing of a story that you'd want to illustrate is something that maybe you shouldn't because,
A story that I was so-so on, but, yeah, it was because we're going to end and we can't mention them all.
No,
but
we can't.
Chasing Volcanoes by Marillag Angway.
I really like that.
That's the airship one.
Yeah, no, I did.
They find a princess.
I clearly like this anthology more than you did. what I really liked about that was I liked the really subtle character shift of the airship captain.
Yeah, but to me that was just so on the nose.
But here's the thing. She didn't change her mind because she realized, oh, no, it'd be wrong to take this princess back and ransom her. She changed her mind because the princess became useful. Like it's this really subtle – and you get the feeling that as they go on, a relationship might develop. But that's why she changed – like the princess is not useful, therefore she'll ransom her and get money.
The moment the princess turns up, there's only one way this story's going to go. You talked about the Afro-SF stories following
that's true.
A certain line.
There is a trajectory.
This, to me –
yeah, well, no, absolutely.
You know from the get-go where this is going to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think some of the stories in this did have that problem. Some were, they had a very They had a very simple trajectory and everything in the story worked along that trajectory and it didn't veer and it didn't – and some of them were nice enough stories to read anyway. But, yes, you know, that's it. Every anthology is going to have stories like that. Every anthology is going to have stories we hate and stories we're just meh about.
That's true.
It's a very rare anthology that you get to the end of every story and go, I'm so glad that was in there.
That's very true. Well said.
The other one
what you just said was an extremely predictable statement.
Shut up. The other story before we end that I just want to point out was Life Under Glass, which is about the two sisters who are out there collecting specimens. In Saigon, there's going to be a big exhibition, and so they're collecting lizards and insects and things to...
I'm staring at you now because...
You don't remember the story. No. Oh, my God, you need to read it. It's really cool. I did read it. They find a lizard that is kind of like a dragon. But it's just a really nice story. Again, it's a nice story about these two sisters and their relationship, which is really deftly done. And, you know, the story about going out and hunting things and finding a dragon, that's just the architecture. The actual story is about... The characters, I guess, emotional narrative and how she...
I have no idea why that story left no impression on me at all. I have no idea. Not to the point where I can't
reader.
Say I liked it or hated it.
Like, there's a dragon.
It left me... I apologise. I apologise. Who's the author?
Oh, gee, Vietnamese name. I'm really going to mangle this. Nghi Vo.
Okay.
That's how I'm saying it. Nghi.
So I apologise. I apologise to Nghi that I completely... blank on her story.
I really liked it.
Well, good, I'm glad.
But I think that, well, we can probably leave off talking about the rest of all the stories.
Yeah, well, there were 34 to talk about. We're never going to cover them all.
But they're our favourites.
Overall, I would say I liked both collections.
I'm glad I read both collections.
Yes, there were some surprising stories. I have to say that... Yeah, the Heresy, Planet X, Working Woman, and the one by Timothy DeMicali, whose title I can't remember.
About the sky whales,
yes.
The consequence of sound.
Yes. They were the
standouts.
The
for
standouts
you.
For yeah. me, yeah. But yeah. There were some other good stories in there in both of them as well. Very much worth reading. But I go back to what I said in the middle of this podcast where we had that 10-minute rant. That it's got to be more than just this.
Of course. And it is. And it's out there. And we just don't see it. And that's the problem. We don't see it. Because it doesn't make it to big publishers and awards lists and big review sites. And I don't know what to do to change that. Other than people like us finding these books and talking about
them. And it's good to see that Ivor Hartmann's done a second book.
Yeah, yeah.
Afro-SF Volume 2 with 6 novellas. So that's, you know, and people should check that out. But and as I said, the Lightspeed Gang, as I call them, I don't know why, because those guys are doing their thing with Kickstarter, and so this stuff is coming out.
And people just need to talk about it.
It's got
to
be more than just that, though.
Well, that's the start.
But not that I can do anything.
Has to be starts.
I just don't want to.
Can't have everything at once.
I don't want 2015 to be the start. I wanted it to
have been 2016.
Well, whatever. I want it to have been already.
Well, you can't change that.
I know.
All you can do is go forward and...
Let's not have the same conversation again. And I'm expressing myself, you know...
But
as
overall...
I recommend that people buy them because, we've probably spoiled some of the stories, but...
And, you know, I do know now, I think definitively, that the steampunk's not for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty much
it's like, yeah.
there mm. to say that... Look, it's got to be top notch writing.
Yeah, the stories I really liked, but like all grouped together, it's one I probably should have read piecemeal, I think.
Yeah. So the next episode, oh my God.
Oh my God. What is
it? Is our 50th.
50th.
Now.
What are we doing, Ian?
We're not doing what you'd expect.
No. Well.
What would you expect?
We'd expect two books, wouldn't you?
Yeah. And you'd expect maybe that we'd get two books from, I don't know.
1950.
Yeah.
Or, that actually would have been a good idea.
Actually, that would have been a good idea.
No, never mind.
Should have done that.
Yeah, better idea.
Or books with the word 50 in the title.
No, that's not a good idea.
No, that's a shitty shitty thing. Or books where the number 50 is focus of the plot.
I can't even think of one.
Neither can I. Instead, what we're doing you and I are taking 25 books and talking about them on the podcast.
Yes.
That's exactly what we're
25
doing.
25 each. 50 25 books. 25 each.
No, so we're... We're doing 50 books now.
Listeners, you can all pick yourselves up off the floor now.
We're not going to spend 20 minutes on each of these because my wife will divorce me and we will probably die at some point during
And I will podcast. Need to urinate.
At some point, yeah.
During a discussion of 50 books for 20 minutes.
I've been wanting to urinate for half an hour and I haven't
said anything. Yeah, I always want to urinate.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad we mentioned that. So what we're going to – the basic idea is that, as Kirsten explained it to me so long ago when she first had the idea.
That you were really excited about.
Which I am – no, I still am. And, in fact, I've been coming up with a list, is to pick 25 books each that were important in our lives. They don't necessarily have to be good books.
They're not our top books. They're our favourite books.
Yeah.
I think.
Books that inspired us and or were influential.
Yep.
The sort of books that we can actually think of off the top of our heads that we don't have to go research our Goodreads guide to see.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And it's, you know, it'll be really interesting. We may not end up with 50 books. It'll be interesting to see among our 25 books each if there's overlap.
We have a couple of rules and I'm going to stick to it. Well, one rule. Yeah.
What's the rule?
No multiple author.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
So it's got to be the one book. So for
you cannot have 10 Stephen King books.
Because I would have done 10 Stephen King books. But as it happens, as I've been thinking about this, I've actually come across some other authors of my childhood that I want to talk about.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I think I'm going to do mine in chronological order.
Now, can I ask you of this?
Yes.
Kirsten, can we for that episode not put show notes of the books?
I don't think we'll put show notes of the books.
Okay.
Because again, listeners, don't worry. Don't panic. We're still going to try and keep this podcast down to, you know, 90 minutes or so because it will literally be just this book and here's a quick sentence or two about why I like it.
Yes.
And moving on. And Ian and I will alternate and we should get this done pretty quickly.
Yes. I think that's not what you've just described will not happen because I will mention a book and you'll go, for reals? Or you'll mention a book and I'll say, oh, shit, that should have been on my list. And we'll, you know, that'll be that sort of discussion. In fact, I can probably predict the whole podcast right now.
You know what? We should have alternates so we end up with 50 books.
Wait, wasn't that what we were going to do?
No, we should have alternates so that if you mention a book that's on my list, like, swap it out. So we end up with 50 books.
No, I'm sticking to 25.
I'm just being a bit too,
Anyway, that's what we're doing. So it means that everyone, including us, gets a month off.
From reading other books. Yes, that's very true. And it's a good month to do it because I'm going off to the to Contact, which is the National Science Fiction Convention, which is happening in Brisbane over Easter this year and doing a whole bunch of other things. So I will not actually have a lot of time to read.
And linked to that is the idea that we will not be doing a podcast. We're doing a podcast in April, but it'll be a little bit later then.
It'll be a little bit later because, I will be away for the first week of April. So, we'll do it in the middle of the month and it'll get released kind of near the end of the month, like we used to do at old school.
Yes, old school. Yeah. Anywho.
So that's exciting. Are you excited? I'm really excited.
I am actually excited because there are some books that are popping into my head that I haven't thought of.
I think I'm actually going to find it hard to keep it to 25.
I'm going to struggle, but we'll get there.
I think we will.
I'm just trying to think which of the least sexist Dean Koontz books I should mention.
Spoilers, I will not have a single Dean Koontz book on my list.
And I do have to say this straight up, and I'm going to say it again next month. There's going to be a lot of white males in my 25.
There is, but I think it will be interesting. And these are books which are – we're not going to be trying to say these are the best books ever written or these would make a top 10 of significant books in blah, blah, blah. These are just books that we've read over our lifetimes that have stuck with us and meant something to us.
Yes.
So I think it'll be really fun. I'm really interested to hear what your list is.
Are you?
Well, I wouldn't be doing the – oh, my God. Like, can I just say, because I know I've said the word a lot this podcast, and probably, like, I'm reclaiming the word interesting. When I say interesting, it is literally meaning interesting. And when I say literally, it is meaning literally. Like, I am really genuinely interested to hear what your top 25 is, Ian.
And I'm
meaning that in a sarcastic way.
I'm interested to hear yours. All right, well, that's it for me.
That's it. So have a month off reading books we've recommended, people. Still read other books. You can catch up. And, yeah, we'll see you in April.
Bye.
With a list of 50 books.
Oh, wait a sec.
Oh, wait, what?
Please.
This is what happens when you run the show.
Oh, shut up. Please send feedback by commenting at website writerandcritic.podbean.com.
Okay, email.
No, I'm not doing it again. Emailing us, writerandcritic@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at writerandcritic. And, Beth, and there's now a fourth dot point. And sponsor us on Patreon, if you can.
And if you love us.
And if you love us.
Have you noticed what that's replaced? There were always four dot points.
What was the? What did it replace?
Never mind. Bye, listeners. See you next month.
Bye.
Ichi ni san shi shi kaku. Ichi ni san shi shi kaku. Oki shi kaku. Di-sa-shi-ka-ku. Yoku dekimashita, yoku dekimashita, yoku dekimashita.
Yay!
That's fantastic.
Yay!
Now will you stop exploiting your children?
Yes, I will.
Okay.
We're not making that a Patreon level.
No, I know.